topic for tonight is, who is a Jew? So, we left off last time with the election to the Third Knesset in 1955, and one of the final points I made was that the Third Knesset was actually a very stable Knesset and lasted almost the whole term, 4 years, until 1959, and that during that time there were only two governments, two cabinets, and they were basically the same. That there was a cabinet crisis in late 1957, where Ben-Gurion resigned, you know, briefly and fired everyone, and brought back the very same people over an issue of news media leaks regarding a trip of Moshe Dayan to West Germany regarding arms sales. But basically, there was stability in government, and what's almost a non-story politically was the 1956 Suez War. You would think that wars in Israeli history are big deals, and they are. And if this were a military course, then we'd discuss it at length. And even if this were a diplomatic course, we'd discuss it at length. But since we're discussing politics, as an internal domestic matter, it wasn't much of a deal at all. Ben-Gurion had to eliminate Moshe Sharet as the foreign minister in 1956 because he represented the moderate wing of the Mapai, the Havlaga wing, that wasn't interested in bellicosity and going to unnecessary wars. But once he was ousted in favor of Golda Meir, it was really his choice and only his choice to wage war. He sent off the IDF chief of staff, Moshe Dayan, and the director general of the defense ministry, Shimon Peres, off to Paris to lay the groundwork for an alliance with Britain and France. And ultimately, the decision was made by Ben-Gurion in late October of 1956 to go to war, and the war was successful. The major political problem was, after the war was over, what to do with the victory, because there was intense political pressure put upon Israel by the United States and by the Soviet Union and by many other parties as well to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip.
This is Eisenhower,
right? And the war happened at this simultaneous with Eisenhower's re-election and also simultaneous with the Soviet invasion of Budapest. So there's a lot going on in the world at that very moment. The same moment, three things are happening of tremendous consequence all around the world. So Ben-Gurion, in one of his more fiery moments, he mentioned that Sharm el-Sheikh had once been part of the Solomonic Kingdom of Israel, and therefore shall never be relinquished ever. And he had these moments where he would hearken back to the Bible and say that the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael are wide and great, and we shall have them for ourselves. But ever the realist politician that he was, and recognizing the need to not alienate the major powers, eventually he capitulated, and there would be an Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai Peninsula, even from Sharm el-Sheikh, and even from the Gaza Strip. And although the Israeli government did not agree to allow the Egyptians' military to move back into the Gaza Strip, upon withdrawing, there was no way to stop the Egyptian military from moving back in, and so they did. But all this happened slowly and over time between the first week of November of 56 and early March of 57. And the reason why they took their merry sweet time was because Moshe Dayan understood there'd be a round three of fighting. When? Nobody could know, but there would certainly be another round. And where would that fighting take place? In the Sinai. So Dayan and his higher ranking officers spent much time riding around in half tracks all over the Sinai Peninsula so that they should know it personally, that they should not have to rely upon maps and aerial surveillance, but they should know the terrain because we'll be back. And they were 11 years later, yeah.
What did they get out of it, the Israelis?
Okay, so the gain from Israel's perspective was a major decline in Fedayeen attacks, which throughout the early 1950s had been devastating and with tremendous loss of life. And the other thing is, the Egyptian military was kept distant from the border, and there would be a United Nations peacekeeping force that would separate the warring parties. Now, the United Nations peacekeeping force did not exist until this conflict. The United Nations is an organization founded in 1945 that is supposed to do good in the world, but it did not have people with guns. Even in a peacekeeping capacity, it had not been even conceived of. It was not until the Canadian Foreign Minister, Lester Mike Pearson, came up with the idea of having the white helmets and the blue helmets that this came to pass. And so the first peacekeeping mission was in the Sinai Peninsula to separate Israel from Egypt. It worked for 10 years. It ultimately fails because it required the cooperation of both sides. And as soon as Nasser requested that they be removed in May of 1967, they were removed. Yeah.
Eisenhower had a fit with the Ben-Gurion of Israel about going into Sinai, but they went in there with the cooperation with British and French.
Yes.
Did he have a canary with them also?
Not nearly as much. They're, after all, they're not nearly as beholden to the United States as is a small Middle Eastern country with 2 million residents. Okay. So, just all this was just to say that the Suez War was not a major political issue in Israel because the decision to go to war was made by one man and rubber-stamped by a compliant cabinet. And the decision to evacuate the conquered territories, that was much more controversial, with the activist parties, notably the Achdut HaAvodah and the Chayrut, not being in favor of a withdrawal. The more dovish parties in government and in the Knesset, notably the left side of the left side of the Mapai, the General Zionist, the National Religious Party, all favored evacuating the conquered territories in favor of some diplomatic arrangement, even if not a final diplomatic arrangement. Okay, so let's now go to the big issue that occupied the government's attention in 1958 and led to a change in personnel in the cabinet. So, in 1955, Achdut HaAvodah and Mapam joined the government for the first time. And they had to be given some of the spoils of governing, some juicy ministries. The Ministry of the Interior had historically been in the hands of the religious parties, notably the NRP, National Religious Party, and it would be later on. And the reason why the religious parties want the Ministry of the Interior is because it determines the personal status of the people, the citizenry. And since religion plays an important role in determining your religious, your personal status, that's why the religious parties want this. In addition to wanting the Ministry of Religions, the Ministry of Welfare, and maybe even the Ministry of Education later on in Israeli history. But Interior is a big deal. I mean, for the last 30 years, Shas has always coveted that ministry. Aryeh Deri has always wanted it for himself. Well, back in the old days of the 50s, Ben-Gurion has to give that up. And he gives it to Yisrael Bar Yehuda of the Achdut HaAvodah. Now, as a secular socialist Zionist, Yisrael Bar Yehuda does not necessarily have a traditional view of who is a Jew. So, the question is, if every citizen has to carry an ID card, and that ID card has on it Le'om, nationality, and Dat, religion, for most people, it's going to say Yehudi and Yehudi, Jewish and Jewish. Of course, if you're Arab, it's going to say Aravi and either Muslimi or Notri, whatever your religious preference might be. But what about people who are ambiguous? Now, the classic example is a mixed marriage where the mother is not Jewish and the father is Jewish. But the parents would like the child to be registered as a Jew. They both, including the non-Jewish mother, want the child registered as a Jew. What do you do? Or, a person comes to Israel and professes in good faith, without any documentation, that they are Jewish. Is that sufficient to get government cooperation with your paperwork? These are big issues.
Are you talking nationality or are you talking
religion? Let's assume that they're one and the same, but especially nationality. Now, why is any of this relevant from the standpoint of the government as opposed to the religious authorities, like the rabbinate? Well, the government cares about security considerations. And if you're not Jewish, then you're a suspect. Especially if you're not Jewish and you're an Arab. Okay? If you're not Jewish by dint of some halakhic consideration, but you're not an Arab and you come from Europe or the Americas, are you a security threat?
No.
Probably not. No. But how do you put that down on paper? How do you clarify that on a card? Those are the issues in play. So, on July 15th, 1958, the National Religious Party members of government resigned when they found out that Yisrael Bar Yehuda, as the Minister of the, Minister of the Interior, was accepting good faith declarations of adults that they are Jewish without any documentation, and the say-so, the declaration of two parents, including a mixed marriage, that the children shall be regarded as Jewish, which is against the halakha in the case of a non-Jewish mother. So they bolted from the government and said, this is a disgrace, it's terrible, terrible. You can't do this. Well, Ben-Gurion wants to resolve this crisis. He doesn't want to have the Mizrahi parties, or now it's one party, out of government, since there is a historic cooperation between labor Zionism and religious Zionism. So he doesn't want to lose them forever as possible members of his government. They're very reliable on matters of war and peace. They basically are aligned with him. So why lose them on a petty religious matter or a bureaucratic matter like an ID card? So what does he do? He sends a letter to 47 of the sages of Israel. Now, when I say Israel, what do I mean? I don't mean the state of Israel. I mean the Jewish people, like the Chachmei Yisrael, in the broader sense. Doesn't matter where they live. They could live in America. They could live in Europe. They could live in Israel. Sages. I didn't classify their religious orientation just yet. Okay, and what is he asking them? Their opinion on this sensitive subject. So, he was, there was a committee formed by the government, which included the Prime Minister, Ben-Gurion, the Justice Minister, Pinchas Rosen, and the Interior Minister, Yisrael Bar Yehuda, that was authorized to consult with the sages the Jewish sages in Israel and abroad, and to formulate registration guidelines that accord with the tradition accepted by all circles of Judaism, the Orthodox and the liberal of all trends, and with special circumstances of Israel as a sovereign Jewish nation, ensuring freedom of conscience and religion, and as the center for the ingathering of the exiles. Now, that's a mouthful there. And it's also mutually exclusive, a lot of that stuff. Is there a standard that is universally accepted among the Orthodox and the liberal of all trends? No, certainly not on Jewish status, not even on petty matters like, you know, what time to light candles. So, halachas kama v'kama on a heavy issue like who is a Jew. Also, what is this business of Israel as the place of the ingathering of the exiles on the one hand, and on the other, ensuring freedom of conscience and religion? So, it's pulling in two opposite directions. On the one hand, Israel as the ingathering of the exiles means that you recognize there'll be a lot of quirky cases since people are coming from all over the world, but you want to have unity when they get here, which would mean a standard that is most likely to be accepted by the traditionalists, and yet freedom of conscience and freedom of religion, which means that people are free to do whatever they want, including identify themselves as Jews, despite, according to the tradition, them not really being Jewish. Freedom of conscience means I can say and profess what I choose without some hierarchy imposing their will upon me. So there are polar opposite forces here in play, and Ben-Gurion wants to thread the needle and find the perfect solution. He doesn't have it, therefore turn to the so-called sages. Yeah.
Why is Israel turning to the outside world?
Okay, so that is a response that some of the so-called sages will have for Ben-Gurion, incredulously wondering, why are you asking me?
Why is he asking?
Well, I'm going to explain that at the very end. Yeah.
What made them determine who the sages are?
I'm going to explain that at the very end. It may all be a scam.
Depends on the channel.
It may all be a political scam. So the fix is in. It's 8:33. We have till 9:15. At 9:13, you'll figure out how the fix was in. Okay. So what are the answers? And before we go to the answers, just one more point about Ben-Gurion's letter. He explained that in the modern state of Israel, all forms of religious or anti-religious coercion are banned, and the effort has to be to unify rather than to divide. And he claimed, in Israel, mixed marriage leads to assimilation into Jewish society, not out of Jewish society. That's his argument. Now, you could buy into that or you could reject it totally. But that's his argument, that Israel is different from the diaspora.
Is it true?
I'm not here to pass judgment. I'm just here to say that he's making that claim, and many people would reject it.
Do you have those stats?
I have a stance at 9:14. Okay.
On what did he base
his argument is that if people are coming to Israel, which is 80% Jewish by demographics, and the Arabs are marginalized, so they don't really matter. So basically it's 100% Jewish. And you have a handful of people who are halakhically Gentile, but they're in a family unit which includes mostly Jews, and they're speaking Hebrew and living in a society which has a Judaic-style civilization, even when secularized, then what are they doing? They're becoming a whole lot more Jewish than when they were Polish Catholic 20 years earlier. That's the idea. In other words, for the Jew who married a Shiksa in 1930s Poland and somehow survived the war, and in 1950 made Aliyah to Israel with their Gentile wife, well, what's happening to this Gentile wife? Yeah, she still speaks Polish, but likely her and her children will be Israelized and Judaized, even in the absence of formal religion. Yeah. Right.
That anybody that was remotely Jewish was forced to bear the worst consequences.
Yes.
And now we already have the luxury again of deciding to, you know,
okay, so I'm glad you mentioned this because it's important to clarify. The law of return is not under discussion here. The law of return, which was a very liberal law that allowed for quarter Jews and spouses of Jews entry and citizenship in the state, is not in play here. You're allowed to come in the country. The only question is, once you're here, how does the administrative state identify you on a piece of paper? Which really exists for security considerations, but once you have the piece of paper, there may be further considerations, like if you're called a Jew, but yet the religious authorities think that you're not, they're going to cry foul and say there's hitbolalut, there's assimilation, there's confusion, and we can't tolerate that.
But the religion aside, are there any advantages, economic or social advantages, jobs or social security type?
To being a Jew?
No.
The quarter Jew came in under the law of return.
Yes.
Their nationality, how they describe.
So they would be described as Jewish.
When their nationality.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So the first...
If we have shuls, the child is ready to become a bar mitzvah, and they realize that the mother wasn't Jewish.
These things happen in America all the time.
In America?
Yeah, sure.
And I've heard of cases.
I've been involved in cases like that.
And those are only the ones that you found out about.
There are plenty others we'll never know.
Right. So, that's what's going on in Israel, that's all.
You're right, that no Jewish community was immune to the ravages of Nisuei Tarovet, mixed marriage and assimilation. And that's going to be one of the points we'll raise in the answers. And let's go to the answers. So the first one is from Shai Agnon. Who's Shai Agnon? Nobel-winning author, one of my heroes. Okay, I cited him in one of my recent essays. He said the following, I count myself among the faithful of Israel, who are utterly loyal to the Torah, as interpreted by the sages, whose words are set down in the Shulchan Aruch. I therefore have nothing to add or subtract from their words. Meaning, you're asking me, I'm flattered that you're asking me, but I have nothing to say. There's the tradition is the tradition, you got to stick with the tradition, and I'm not even one of the expositors of the tradition, I'm just a poetry writer. So therefore, I cannot contribute to this discussion in any meaningful way. But,
He was a sage.
You'll see the sage. He got a letter. All these guys got letters. The sages included not just rabbis, but intellectuals, VIPs, people who had opinions about general Jewish affairs. And Agnon certainly fits into the category of an Israeli or Jewish VIP. Okay, no doubt about it. So, but Agnon is forever the writer. And his answer only took up one paragraph. And so he said, I don't want to leave the page half blank. He literally writes, I don't want to leave the page half blank. So he tells a story about when he was on a kibbutz and he met Ben-Gurion years ago. But then the last line is this. Listen to this one. Quote, at the moment, state and religion are like two neighbors who do not regard each other amicably. As a person upon whom the safety and welfare of the state rest, you would do well to refrain from concerning yourselves with matters of religion, whether for good or for ill, in order to leave yourself free for matters of state.
Wow.
In other words, stay out of this, but out of it, because you can only get yourself into trouble, and we need you, Ben-Gurion. You are our hero, you are practically our Messiah, who resurrected the Jewish nation and gave us independence, so keep up the good work on that front. But stick your nose out of religious affairs.
But it seems to be an affair of state.
Mainly. It is, but he's politely saying that you'd better serve not getting involved.
To do with
No. Okay, now Mordechai Kaplan is the next one to answer. And Kaplan is a sage of sociology, not a sage of theology, or certainly not of the Talmud, in my view. But he was the most astute Jewish sociologist of the 20th century. I will give him tremendous credit for that. And he understood something that nobody else picked up on in all the other answers. Brilliant perception of his part. He explained, first of all, Ben-Gurion, your frame of reference is filled with contradictions. We cannot satisfy all the terms that you wanted satisfied. There is no universally agreed upon standard of Jewishness. There is no freedom of religion in Israel, despite your claim that there is. And Israel isn't really a Jewish state, despite your claim that it is. So all the premises are wrong. All right? And this is, Kaplan is a tremendous Zionist, but he's saying, I'm debunking everything in your whole letter. Then he says, I know the real reason why you're doing this. And it's not because you need a piece of paper to identify someone when they get stopped by the police or by the border police or by the security apparatus to know whether they're an Arab terrorist or a Jew. No, you're claiming that's what it is. It's not really. What are you trying to do here? You're trying to boost the Jewish demographics in the state of Israel because you don't like the fact that there are so many Arabs. You don't want it to be 85-15 or 80-20 or 75-25. You want it to be 95-5 or 100% Jewish. And so what are you doing? You're manufacturing Jews out of people who aren't really Jewish. And I understand your desire to do so for matters of realpolitik and international consideration about what, you know, who the citizens of the state are. But let's be honest here, that's what you're doing. Now, who would later claim the same thing and about which demographic group in the 1990s? The Sephardic Jews in Israel, and especially the Ethiopian Jews in Israel, would claim that that very policy was being done with people from the Soviet Union. That any random white guy from the Soviet Union with a slight drop of Jewish blood was being brought in and made an Israeli because we've got to stick it to the Palestinians and outnumber them 3-1. Is there truth to that? Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Let's go. So what does Kaplan offer as a suggestion to this particular problem? He says, well, if you have to make a distinction between people who are really Jewish and people who have Jewish associations, then call the real Jews Jew, and call the other ones, the handful of people of the mixed marriage types, Jewish resident. Jewish resident. Huh? Kosher style, whatever it is. Okay. Now, let's go to the next answer. Alexander.
I'm going to reference matrimonial descent.
So one of the respondents is Solomon Freehoff, the chairman of the Responsive Committee of the Reform Movement, and we'll see what he says. He does make reference to a 1947 decision that we spoke about last year. Okay, so the next one is Alexander Altman. Alexander Altman was a German Orthodox rabbi who then went to England before the Holocaust and then became a professor at Brandeis. Maybe some of you had him as if you went to Brandeis as a professor. Okay, he said, the real question is whether or not you can be a Jew by nationality alone without religion. That is the basic underlying philosophical question. Is it possible? But that's a very troubling thing because historically it wasn't the case. We may want to say it is now for convenience, but it's a departure from the historical norms of Judaism and Jewish identity. So then he says maybe we could skirt this problem altogether by instead of listing that person's ethnicity or nationality, you list the ethnicity of their parents. And when it says that so-and-so's father was a Polish Jew and so-and-so's mother was a Polish Catholic, you'll know they're not a Palestinian terrorist. That's it. Simple as that. Does that work? So the problem with that is it has like racial overtones. It has a certain like to an American and certainly a sort of left of center American Jew, this would not go over well, the notion of recalling somebody's racial or ethnic ancestry in determining their status.
That's like in the States. If your grandfather voted, you could vote. If you
right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Even prove the parents.
So that may be doable because you may have documentary evidence or a person spoke Yiddish. Or there are ways to prove people's Jewish status. Now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Their parents did not give a bris to their children.
Right. They were feared for their safety.
Right. And they did not tell them they were Jewish. And yet, later on in life...
They found out.
they found out.
Yeah.
So it was a funny kind of period.
It was a bizarre period all around. That's right. Now, Altman then continues. He says, if this proves unworkable, then you can simply separate Jewish religion from Jewish nationality and have the religious definition be according to the rabbinical authorities and the nationality be whatever the state feels is necessary. It's not ideal, but so be it. Now, he then says that you have to be careful not to dilute the meaning of the word Jew. And he has an interesting reason why. What is Israel? The word Israel. What does it connote? Forget the modern state of Israel. What does the word Israel mean? Am Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael. It has a very parochial connotation of our people, our heritage, the Judaic heritage. But what does he say, Altman? In our time, writing in the 1950s, the modern state of Israel has compromised the parochial character of the term Israel because there are Israeli Muslims and Israeli Christians and Israeli Arabs, and they're just as Israeli as the Jews. So the word Israel or Israeli doesn't mean what it once meant. It's been compromised. Now, for good reason. You know, thank God there's a Jewish state called Israel. But you don't want to also dilute the term Jew. Therefore, reserve Jew for the people who really deserve it by the religious standards. Okay. So it's a very interesting point, I think. Then he says, don't use the term Hebrew as an alternative for the people of the mixed marriages because it sounds like an inferior term. So he's opposed to creating a third, you know, a third category or another name for the pseudo-Jews, the kosher-style ones. He doesn't like that. It sounds inferior. But then he says, the rabbis have to act charitably in converting children. The rabbis have to act charitably in converting children, because if they do that, then this problem could largely be eliminated. And there's no coercion involved in conversion, because remember, Ben-Gurion is worried about coercion. He says, no, there's no coercion involved here. If you want it, you'll do it. And if you don't want it, you won't do it. And if you don't do it and because you don't want it, and there's an adverse consequence administratively that you can't be labeled a Jew, so be it, but nobody forced you. Nobody forced you. Okay. Now, next one is Harry Wolfson. Who was Harry Wolfson? He was a professor at Harvard. He was the first ever endowed chair of Jewish studies in the United States at Harvard. And he said, don't tamper with the word Jew. If necessary, use the term Hebrew. So Altman said, don't use Hebrew, because it's an inferior term. And Wolfson said, no, it's a perfect idea. Use Hebrew instead of Jew. Okay, Heschel was asked, and it makes sense that if you can ask the sages of Israel, you can ask Abraham Joshua Heschel, because there's no bigger sage of Israel than Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he said, call them Hebrews if you have to come up with a term. So he agrees with Wolfson against Altman. But then Heschel has a broader point to make. And this is a very important point, because it gets to the heart of religious Zionism. And when I say religious Zionism, I don't mean Nafdal political religious Zionism. I mean in the real abstract realm. He says like this, quote, time has come to ask whether there is justification in viewing religion as merely a means to an end or a device for ensuring the survival of the nation. The approach rests on ignorant assumptions. The nation is eternal, and the end itself is basically a religious one. Let me unpack that for you. I lost everybody here. What was he saying? He's saying, listen, I know what the guys like Ben-Gurion think. They think that Judaism, the religion, was around for 2,000 years, and that was a good thing because it kept the Jewish nation alive. That if not for Judaism, the religion, our people, after the destruction of the First and Second Temple and the loss of national sovereignty, would have blended into the rest of humanity and we would not exist anymore as a distinct people. So since we like the fact that we're a distinct people and we want to rebuild our national homeland, so then in hindsight, religion was a useful tool. But we're not frum. So now that there's a nation state, religion kind of is superfluous and can be done away with, except for the people who really want to keep Shabbos. But basically, the Ben-Gurions of the world regard religion as having been a useful mechanism for survival when it was needed, but not objectively necessary as an eternal matter. So Heschel says, no, you got it backward. The nation was eternal no matter what. The Jews are indestructible as a people. That you can take for granted. But what is the purpose of our existence? Not to exist like anybody else exists, but for the sake of serving God and higher enlightened and moral purposes. So we need religion as the ultimate ends, not nationalism as the ultimate ends. Of what's the shaykhus, what's the connection between his high rhetoric and the topic in play here. Because what are they discussing here? They're trying to say, well, nationalism, nationality and religion always went hand in hand. But now they don't need to, because nationality is really important. Religion is kind of superfluous, and only for the people who care about it should they consider using it. And Heschel says, no, they go together, and if anything, the one that's more important is religion. So reorient your thinking on the whole topic. That's what Heschel is telling Ben-Gurion. No, but what ends up happening is that religion gets dropped, because one of the suggestions that is made by several of the respondents here is let the card not be relevant, even if it says religion. Let there be a fine print with an asterisk that says the ecclesiastical authorities are not bound by what this document says, meaning it's not definitive proof for those bureaucratic purposes, and it's not. And on the cards today, it doesn't have a religion. Yeah.
They had it always pronounced.
They weren't. They were not. They were sent by mail to the Prime Minister's office, and later they were published. But consider a while later. Now, in the YU library. So Sunday night, I went to the library to read this stuff, and unfortunately, there are two books. Neither one was satisfactory to me. One was in English, and one was in Hebrew. But I didn't want a translation in English or in Hebrew. I wanted the originals, and some of them were in English, and some of them were in Hebrew. And I wanted to see all of them in the original, but I couldn't get that. I'm not even sure which ones were written in Hebrew. Most of them were written in Hebrew, because most of them were written by Israelis and or rabbinical figures. But some were written in English or French. Yes, we shall see soon. Okay. Yep.
I'm Israeli.
That's right. I've heard that many times. Many times I've heard that.
You have to do it because you live in America, so it's, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
What, you,
not for me.
I don't understand what that means.
It's a cop out, but.
I don't have to do what?
Keep kosher, the like. Okay, so let's go to the next answer. Hugo Bergman, also a professor at Hebrew U.
Doesn't that come from the Torah too? There's a part where it says they ate treif and all these things in Israel?
That was, but that was not said in the favorable context. During the conquest of Eretz Canaan, they were allowed to eat katli the chaziri, pork. It says so in the Gemara, not in the Bible itself, but in the Gemara it says that. Okay, so Hugo Bergman said that we hope that one day the halakha and secular assumptions will be in line with each other, but they're not now. So in the meantime, what choices do we have to solve this particular problem? So one option is, delete the line about religion. Just keep nationality and delete religion. And hopefully that will satisfy the religious people as to not be contrary to their wishes. Or label the kids Jewish by parental declaration. Meaning, the government takes no position on the status of the child. It just alerts the police officer who stops the kid with an arrest that this person is Jewish by parental declaration. It's a nice idea. It does solve the problem, and it's very honest. It's not very definitive. Okay. Now, the next one was Yehuda Burla, who was a writer, Israeli writer. He said, what's the problem here? The problem is that certain people have a religious status that isn't what we, the Zionists, want to recognize as their national status. So where is the onus? The onus is on the rabbis. And you know what? The rabbis change religion all the time. After all, lex talionis. What does it say in the Bible? An eye for an eye. And what is it? Money. Or polygamy is allowed. And what happened? Came along Rabbeinu Gershom, and it's not allowed. So you know what? We can change the rules about who's Jewish. Then he ends with, v'chai b'hem. You have to live by them. And if the laws turn out to be unlivable, you change them. So that was Burla's opinion. All right, he was rejected. All right. Now we go to Solomon Freehoff. Solomon Freehoff, as I mentioned, was the chairman of the response committee of the CCAR, the Reform Rabbis. And he writes to Ben-Gurion, he says, I assume you're writing to me in my capacity as chairman of the response committee. So it's like on his high horse. So therefore he says, I'm going to write to you a long treatise explaining the true meaning of Jewish status. So whereas others suffice with one or two pages of practical suggestions, Freehoff, the Gadol HaDor, he thought what he was in his own mind, writes a 20-page essay about who is a Jew. All right. Then he says, the matter is much more complicated than Orthodox law might indicate. Now, he's not wrong on that. I gave a whole lecture, was it a year and a half ago, about matrilineal descent, and it's a complicated issue. It's not so simple. But What Friedhof says is in 1947, the Reform rabbis made a ruling that said that if you were a half-Jew, the wrong half, the patrilineal, that you, if the kid is enrolled into the cheder and goes up through confirmation, then his education or her education will be regarded in lieu of a conversion ritual. So they're a convert without having to submit to whatever ceremonials typically are done. Then Friedhof says, let's make a chiluk, let's make a distinction between a ger tzedek and a ger toshav. So the Bible, now the Bible doesn't really do this, because the Bible just has one type of ger, and it's ambiguous as to what that ger really means. It's not a topic for tonight. But in Talmudic Judaism, there's ger tzedek and ger toshav, the righteous proselyte, who's a full-fledged Jew, and the resident alien, who has certain rights and is Judaic in certain respects, but not entirely. So Friedhof then says, but wait a second, you might say that the Talmud admits that the ger toshav concept went out of style, or ceases to be relevant, when all of Klal Yisrael is not in its land, after the Yovel is no longer applicable, the Jubilee, after the loss of national sovereignty. But I have a solution. What is it? The modern state of Israel. So we're no longer a diaspora people and exiled people. We're now people in our own land, and we can bring back the notion of the Ger Toshav. And so who is the Ger Toshav? The guy who speaks Hebrew, who had a non-Jewish mother, who serves in the army, you know, who's Israeli in all respects, and half-Jewish, the wrong half, but is Israeli in all respects. So we'll call him Ger Toshav, pseudo-Jewish.
Did Ben-Gurion think he was going to get any consensus? Like
No. But that's if soon enough we'll discuss what he really was trying to get here. Yes. Yes.
The conversion fight today isn't what it was.
No, it's not the same thing as it was back then. And one of the answers will relate to that very point. We got to go fast now. So Chaim Cohen was the Attorney General of the state, and he said the parental declaration is the way to go. Even though it's contrary to the tradition, in a modern state, we have to go with the parental declaration because there is gender equality in Israel, and a mother and father are equally parents of the child, and so we have to respect the declaration made by a mother, who herself happens to not be Jewish, just as much as we would respect a declaration made by a father who happens to be Jewish. That's his argument. And he's a yeshiva graduate, but he was the Attorney General of the state, and he says, even though the religious parties are not going to like this, it's the most fair thing to do. Now, Dante Lattis, who was an Italian Jew, he said, register them as Jews, because they're part of the Jewish people growing up in Israel and speaking Hebrew. And as for the card that they get by the government, it has no bearing on religious status, and the rabbis will bring them closer to Judaism when the time comes. In other words, let the rabbis worry about how from these people are going to be, or not at all. But as for the government, to just register them as Jews. Okay.
It's a separation of church and state, I guess.
Basically, yes. Now, the next answer is Louis Finkelstein. If you remember from when we discussed conservative Judaism, Louis Finkelstein had a certain attitude towards halachic pronouncements. He personally stayed away from them. He did not like to get himself down and dirty in the thick of halachic dispute, because he wanted to have JTS be an elite institution. He's an ivory tower kind of guy. So he writes back saying, "You know, this is not my normal place to discuss these things, and there are experts greater than I. I'm not competent to rule. But if you ask my practical opinion on these things, my answer is keep with the tradition. And as for those who are harmed by it, meaning the half-Jews who now have a disadvantage administratively, explain it to them with empathy and with a warm heart. In other words, just be nice to them, even though you're not satisfying what they want."
He was a from guy himself.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Now, the next few answers are from people who say, I can't tell you anything. Felix Frankfurter was asked. Now, Felix Frankfurter is an American Supreme Court justice, right, appointed by Roosevelt in 1939, and is not a religious Jew, but was a lukewarm Zionist. Not even lukewarm, a warm Zionist. And so it's not surprising that on a legal matter, Ben-Gurion, if he's going to the sages of Israel, and the sages are interpreted loosely, that you'd go to a Supreme Court justice in America. And he says, even assuming I was equipped to deal with it, the question concerns actions on the part of the government of Israel. One in my position must keep aloof from all participation in governmental problems, except as what comes before the court. All the more so regarding actions of a foreign country, meaning I can't get involved in politics,
right.
Certainly not American politics, and even not your politics. I just have to focus on the court. I can't misharine in somebody else's business. Okay? Yeah. Even though...
Is that misharine?
No, because he didn't speak Yiddish, But but he says, as much as Israel is close to my heart, I can't intrude on your affairs. Then Isaiah Berlin, the great philosopher, a British Jew, he says, my apologies for not writing in Hebrew, but I don't know it so well. So this is the only one that I know that wasn't written in Hebrew for sure, because he says it wasn't written in Hebrew. But there were others also that were written in other languages. And he says, I do not believe that much good can come from consulting people outside the frontiers of the state of Israel on a matter which is the administrative responsibility of the government of Israel. So, bingo. And it's, why are you asking outsiders? Ask your own people, your own sages, but don't go beyond the frontiers of the country. It's silly. It doesn't make any sense. And he doesn't offer a real answer. He just says, that's it. I can't give you a solution. Simon Rifkin, who is a judge, an American judge, and an important Jew in like American Jewish committee circles, you know, the elite, the German Jewish elite of this country, he said, I am not qualified to express an opinion deserving of consideration. I may know American law, but I don't know your affairs in Israel, and I don't know Jewish law. The next one was Dr. Joseph Schechter. This is the funniest one of them all. He says, quote, I was quite surprised to receive your letter. While I have acquired a certain amount of general knowledge as a physician, I have little Jewish learning. Then he says, just keep the traditional definition, don't follow the spirit of the times, because after all, these times are worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. Meaning we just had a Holocaust, you know, the 20th century is a brutal century, so don't think the zeitgeist is so wonderful, stick with the tradition. Now, why did he start off the letter by saying, I'm surprised I got your letter? The answer is because there was a noted educator and philosopher by the name of Professor Dr. Joseph Schechter. This guy was an obstetrician, a totally different person. They sent it to the wrong address. Okay, now we go to the Orthodox rabbis, because up until now it really hasn't been Orthodox rabbis. So, let's go first to Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin at the time was the chief rabbi of the army, would go on in 1972 to be elected chief Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, and he says, if you recognize non-Jews as Jews by nationality, it would mean that the Israeli government is sanctioning assimilation. It would be a shanda. And he says, that's about the children, but he even says the policy of good faith declarations by adults is also against the halakha. Everything has to have documentation. Now, this is an important point, because remember, Rav Gorin is regarded not as a fundamentalist extremist. He was very accommodationist, and in the famous matter of the Langer twins, the Ach v'Achot, what did he do? He officiated at their wedding, much to the chagrin of the Charedim, and that's why Rav Elyashiv turned against the rabbinate, a very famous case. Okay, so he was very much an accommodationist. And in our time, what happens? Everybody complains about the rabbinate. They want too many paperwork, it's impossible. They always turn people away, even with the paperwork. And Rav Gorin, supposedly the moderate here, says, no, you have to have paperwork. We can't just accept your good faith declaration. It could be total falsehood. All right. So what does he suggest for the children? He has a very good suggestion. He says, on their card it should say, professing Judaism. Not that they're Jewish, but that they're professing Judaism. Which means that they're making an assertion. We may not agree with it, but it's their assertion. Now, does he have any biblical justification for that attitude? He does. Megillat Esther, chapter 8, verse 17. V'rabim me'ameh ha'aretz mit yahadim. Bingo. Okay, what is mit yahadim? They're passing themselves off as Jewish. Now, self-conversion, or even in the absence of conversion, portraying the image that I am a Jew, even though they ethnically are not. So, mit yahadim, professing Judaism.
They did that out of fear.
All right, so that's because Mordechai was on top at that point, and Haman was down and dead, and the Jews were powerful. Okay, so that's not a bad idea. Now, the next one is Shalom Isaac Halevi, and he says it's inadvisable to cause a major upheaval for a very small number of non-Jews. Now, this is an important point because in 1958, you could say that. It was a pretty small number. By 1998, it's not a small number anymore. So, if the issue is, well, why cause a big disturbance over a minor matter, you could say that only when it's a minor matter, not when it's a 250,000 people from the Soviet Aliyah. Okay. The next one was the chief rabbi of Israel. Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog says to Ben-Gurion, the mitzvot are not for us to tinker with. Plain and simple. It's a very short letter. We're not free to mess around with religion. So Ben-Gurion, take the message. Listen to the chief rabbis. Don't change the policy. The chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi, Rav Herzog. Okay, then the London Beit Din chimes in. The London Beit Din, which is a very important European Beit Din, it's been around for a long time, 200 years more, they say, you shouldn't be asking anyone, Ben-Gurion, because the chief rabbis of Israel have already spoken, and their opinion is the only one that matters. Okay, then, this is a good one, quote, we cannot ignore the fact that you have found it appropriate to address your inquiry on what is undoubtedly a halakhic matter to people who are neither qualified to pronounce on religious law nor familiar with Jewish tradition, a step unprecedented in history, meaning you're asking people who may be Jewish VIPs and professors in a university here or there, or wherever, but they're not halakhist and they're not even religious Jews. So what are you doing asking them this sort of question? It's unprecedented. Never was there before that you're going to ask on a essentially halachic matter the viewpoint of people who are so far removed from the Da'at Amot Shel Halacha. Okay.
How did he know that this was being sent to nine?
So it was, the list of recipients of the letter was made public right away. Was made public right away. Their answers were not, but the list was. Okay. The next one is Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich. Okay? And he said, listen, Ezra kicked out the foreign wives. And Ezra didn't live in Woodmere. Ezra lived in Eretz Yisrael. So don't tell me that the chiluk, the distinction is between Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael, that in the Chutz La'aretz you have to worry about assimilation and intermarriage because we're all going to fall apart and disappear from the scene, but in Israel all is secure. No, even in Eretz Yisrael, nothing is secure. And therefore, you can't register halachic non-Jews as Jews by nationality or religion because we have to worry about hitbolalut, assimilation, just as much as the Jews in the Western world. Others would argue with that point, but he has biblical precedent.
You did mention the opposite when somebody said the assimilation in Israel will be pro-Israel, pro-Jew.
That's Ben-Gurion's point of view. That's he tries to...
Turn it on its head.
Well... Ben-Gurion says what he says because he's hoping for a progressive answer even from non-progressive people. But he's not getting those sorts of answers. He's getting the reverse. You have to worry about assimilation everywhere. Okay. Rav Aaron Cutler from Lakewood, Bespendish Gavoa, gives an answer. And he says, like the London Beit Din, I can't believe, I'm amazed that you're asking people questions who are not Torah scholars and they're not even religious, as well as people who have severed almost every link with the Jewish people. In other words, people on the margins of Jewish life in the diaspora, who, aside from the fact that they eat pork, are so distant from Judaism and the Jewish identity, why are you asking them these questions? Now, who he had in mind of the list of the 50, I wonder. But then again, from Rav Kotler's point of view, probably anybody who's not eating, you know, having Chol of Yisrael is already beyond the fold. I'm sure he would think even Louis Finkelstein, you shouldn't be asking him. Everyone has their own theory as to who's appropriate of a respondent.
So that brings up the question, among the Orthodox rabbinate, you have a division of opinion, so you can't even really rely on their opinion.
Well, thus far, no Orthodox rabbi has suggested registering as Jews someone who is a non-Jew. At most, you've had Rav Gorin, who offered another terminology of professing Judaism. Okay, then Rav Weinberg, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, so the former rector of the Berlin Seminary, a major, major posek, okay? So what does he say? The Prime Minister made a big mistake. These are fraudulent half-Jews who will betray the nation. And a nationalist conversion, meaning conversion without religious conversion, but just to the nationality of the Jewry, is bogus and accepted by nobody. Now this is very tough language. He's saying they're going to betray the nation. They're about like a fifth column. They're going to spy for the enemy. Yes, I was shocked that Rav Weinberg said these things because he's normally not a radical fundamentalist. He normally has a sober head on him on many halakhic issues, and yet here, breathing fire against any progress whatsoever. Now, Rav Soloveitchik wrote an answer together with Rav Chaim Heller. Who was Rav Chaim Heller? So he lived in Washington Heights. He was he was from Berlin. He's like an Orthodox Wissenschaft des Judentum type, Orthodox academic studies. And they basically said, just stick to the tradition, and Ben-Gurion, we revere your name and all you have done for Klal Yisrael. So they really kind of kiss up to Ben-Gurion with very flowery language in a short letter that was only one page saying, just stick to the tradition. Okay. Now we get to Yecheskel Kaufman. Who is Yecheskel Kaufman? So he wrote A History of the Jewish Religion. Was a very famous professor of Judaic studies and ancient Jewish history in the first half of the 20th century in Israel. And he said, you can solve the problem by being very lenient in Ger Katan. What is Ger Katan? Child conversion. That if you're lenient in that, you could solve a lot of these problems. So now the next answer is going to push back against that. Saul Lieberman. The Grush, Shaul Lieberman, JTS, the greatest Talmudist of the 20th century. He said, the kid, the patrilineal Jewish kid, is a goy. And no declarations will change that. No matter what you say, the kid is a goy. And the rabbis will not convert the child if the parents are not interested in raising him in a religious environment. So all this talk about being lenient regarding Ger Katan, Lieberman says, forget about it. The rabbis aren't going to do it, and they shouldn't do it. And then he says, whatever the personal tragedy of the parents, don't make a mockery of conversion. He says, I understand the parents have tzaras with the legal identity of their children. But as much as we empathize with their tzaras, don't make a mockery of conversion. If the kid isn't Jewish, he's not Jewish. And don't try to make him Jewish if he isn't going to be religious, because we don't have bogus conversions. All right. Now then he says, watering down the standard in Israel would really be embarrassing. Why? Quote, let us not create a situation for ourselves whereby people can say the following. If you want to get rid of your non-Jewish wife, go to Nevada for an easy divorce. If you want to marry a non-Jewish wife and have her bear so-called Jewish children, go to the holy city of Jerusalem. So the dichotomy would be odd. You could get rid of the shiksa wife by going for a quickie divorce in Las Vegas, but if you want that shiksa wife to have a so-called Jewish child, just go to Israel and they'll call him Jewish. Yeah. So that was Lieberman using a little hyperbole. And he says in no uncertain terms, the government should not be too ashamed to say we were wrong and we're changing policy. Now, the sharpest of all the answers was from Yehuda Leib Maimon. Okay, Rabbi Maimon, Rabbi Fishman, who was in the government, Minister of Religious Affairs, Minister of Welfare, the founder of the Mizrahi, the founder of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. Okay, he's the leading figure of the Mizrahi. And if you remember from a few weeks ago, what did he say about Ben-Gurion to his son-in-law? Remember what I said, Rabbi Maimon said about Ben-Gurion? When his son-in-law asked him, how could it be that a non-religious Jew is like the savior of our people, Ben-Gurion. And Maimon said to his son-in-law, thank God he's not religious, because if he were religious, people would think he was Mashiach ben David. That's how much Maimon revered Ben-Gurion. All right, and they collaborated in many ways for a long time. But on this one, Maimon let it all out. He said, I have no relation to some of those intellectuals who you have asked, and I don't trust their intellect. I read the whole letter, and despite the considerable heartache, pain, and sorrow you have caused me, in particular your grave error regarding the question of who is a Jew, and then in parentheses, I believe it is the greatest mistake you have ever made. Now that's tough language. Remember, Ben-Gurion is the Prime Minister of Israel, the Defense Minister of Israel, had made many decisions over a public career of a half a century, and people make mistakes. And for Maimon to say this is the greatest mistake you have ever made, not the Battle of Latrun, not losing the old city, nothing of a military... No, this is the greatest mistake you have ever made. And he didn't write that out of hyperbole. He wrote it because he really believed it. Maimon was a sincere, pious traditionalist. Okay? And then he said, I felt proper nevertheless to reply because of our mutual friendship and respect. You need to publicly declare, quote, I was wrong. That's what Maimon wants from Ben-Gurion. Okay, that's very strong language, and he can only get away with it because they really were so close. When you're so close to a person, you can speak harshly. When you don't even have a peripheral relationship with them, you have to be, you know, cordial in your conversation and in your letter writing. Yes, ultimately, yes. Okay, now,
what was that question?
Ultimately, was this viewpoint adopted? And the answer is yes. Uh-huh. Okay. The next two answers, we're running out of time, so we've got to be quick, are from Yosef Kapuch, okay, the Yemenite rabbi who wrote the Perush HaRambam al Mishnayos. He wrote the translation to Hebrew. And Moshe Zilberg. Who was Moshe Zilberg? He was a religious Zionist Jew who was a member of the Israeli Supreme Court. They both basically give the same answer and say, you shouldn't register these non-Jews as Jews by nationality, let alone by religion, because what happens? Matters of marriage and divorce are in the hands of the ecclesiastical authorities. For the Jews, it means the rabbis. And the rabbis won't marry this guy because he's not Jewish. So what happens? They'll grow up thinking they're Jewish. They hit their early 20s, they meet a nice girl, and then what? They can't get married. So you're setting a trap for these people. Don't do that. It's unfair to them. You may think that you're being nice by giving them a Jewish status, but really you're not giving them a Jewish status in the matters that are of most personal concern. So Zilberg says, as long as there's no civil marriage in Israel, you can't do this to them. You have to be upfront and honest about their real status. Of course, since there's still no civil marriage in Israel, how do you resolve the problem of these people? Cyprus or wherever they want to go. They go
civil marriage.
Huh? Well, it doesn't exist. I'm sure Yair Lapid is working on it. Okay, so the last answer for tonight is from Ernst Simon. You probably never heard of him. Ernst Akiva Simon was a professor of education at Hebrew University and was one of those German Jews who made Aliyah early on in the pre-state era, intellectual types, the Brit Shalom type. And he said, you're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. No answer is going to satisfy everyone. No answer is going to be all that good. But Simon, who was not even Orthodox, he was a traditional Jew, he made the following observation. Quote, immigration to Israel involves considerable sacrifice, deriving from the need to adjust to a society, economy, culture, language, and climate that are more or less unfamiliar. It would seem that despite our justified reluctance to impose any form of coercion, we are entitled to demand from a few immigrants for whom the problem exists, the additional sacrifice of acknowledging in practice the right of the Jewish people to ensure its historical continuity and internal unity. In other words, the non-Jews who are half-Jews of the wrong half have to be willing to take one for the team and say, you know what, I'm really just not Jewish. I've moved to Israel, and I'll live my life as an Israeli of dubious Judaic status. Now, so what is Simon's point? Everybody who makes Aliyah sacrifices something. It's not easy to become an Israeli. Everybody has to live in the Ma'barot and have no running water and no electricity and then you go on rations and austerity. It's not easy to be an Israeli. And some people have it a little bit worse in that because of reasons of their parents, their Jewish status is dubious. And you know what? They have to take it for the team and just say, fine, so be it. But Am Yisrael is entitled to its historical continuity, and I, the half-Jew, should not be a reason to impose a new standard or a change in standards upon all of Klal Yisrael. Is this a reasonable argument? I think it is. It's a very moral argument. It recognizes the pain of the individual, but says, listen, this world is a world full of pain, and you'll have a little bit more than everybody else. Okay. Now, I was delaying answering some of the critical questions. Politically, why was Ben-Gurion doing all this? Yes. So, I believe, and this is one of the standard historical theories, that Ben-Gurion did not want to lose the traditional partnership of labor and religious Zionism. He did not want the Mafdal, in the long run, out of the government. So, by placating them, they'd come back in. And in fact, from 1948 through 1977, for 29 years, when labor, or some iteration of the Labor Party, is in power that whole time, only for 1 year was the Mafdal, or some version of the Mafdal, out of the government, 1958 to 1959. And as soon as they got their way, they were back in the next cabinet cycle. So he doesn't want to offend them. And after all, by caving into the traditionalists, who on the left side of the aisle is going to be offended? Well, the handful of half-Jews, and maybe the Mapam, maybe the Achdut HaAvodah, but even they don't really care. They care a little bit in that by their nature, they're progressive on these issues, but it's not a big issue for them. And it is a big issue for the Mafdal and for the Haredim. So therefore, you go with who cares the most. It's a plain and simple political calculation. So what does he do? He rigs the system so that most of the recipients of his letter are Orthodox Jews, and at that Orthodox rabbis, knowing what they will give as their answer. So most of the answers will be stick to the Shulchan Aruch, and a handful of the answers will be progressive answers. It's a strategy. And as for the idea of Hebrew or Jewish resident or professing Judaism or by parental declaration, that's gravy. In other words, some nice ideas that thinking out of the box, maybe we could implement them, maybe. So he has the benefit of extra input from outside sources. But Lamaisa, the bottom line is, he's going to go back to the tradition, and the cabinet crisis will resolve itself.
And now, it's a different story.
Yeah.
It's not just the answer.
Now it's a much bigger problem.
That's next year.
That's, yeah, exactly. And we'll stop here.